What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. It's not 7 yet, so I want to be fair to our viewers, especially because sometimes we've been known to start a little bit late. So I'm going to wait until it's 7. I think we were a little overzealous today because we didn't want to be late, which is admirable. But I don't want people who expect to start 7 to come and feel like they've been missing out. So let's see. Brad, why don't you get on the screen and just say hi to the audience with us?
Hey, Katie.
Hi, Brad. How's it going?
Oh, it's going all right. Oh, it's 7 o'clock.
Okay, and it's 7 o'clock. Okay. Bye. All right. Well, welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I want to officially welcome everyone to the Katie Helper Show. We are so glad to be here today. We have an excellent show for you today. We have three wonderful guests. During the second half of the show, we're going to be speaking to Aaron Good and Ken McCarthy about JFK, the JFK files, whether or not JFK was an anti-imperialist, and RFK Jr. and his interesting politics on Israel and what the root of those are. But during the first half of the show, we're going to be talking to the excellent journalist Norman Solomon, and we're going to be talking to him about so many things, about the new book by Jake Tapper, about Biden's health being covered up. We're going to talk to him about the failure of the Democrats more broadly. We're going to talk to him about Gaza and liberal Zionism and whether that can even exist or it's a contradiction in itself. And Norman Solomon is the co-founder of Roots Action and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. And his books include War Made Easy, Made Love, Got War, and War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. So welcome, Norman. Hi, how are you?
Hanging in.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining.
Pleasure.
There's so much to talk about. And obviously, you're someone who really does focus on the crimes of the Democratic Party in both sense, in the many senses of the word. But before we get into the new book about Joe Biden, which you've reviewed, I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts are right now with Trump, where we are politically, what is the state of American politics, how we got to Trump, and what we can do to fight Trump.
Right now, we're in a really deep hole. We've been trapped in a vice between the neoliberal, corporate, militaristic Democratic Party and an increasingly, I don't even know if neo before fascist is the right term anymore. They are a fascistic party with the kind of politics that is classic for European fascism. The Yale scholar who wrote How Fascism Works, Jason Stanley, point by point, describes the way in which anti-immigrant, super hyper patriarchal hostility to those who are not at the top of the heap, et cetera, et cetera. We are dealing with a kind of a fascistic politics that is running 2.5 parts of the three branches of government, and it's unclear how much they're going to be having leverage over the court system as well. So we're in a very deep, very deep hole, and we're going to have to come to terms with it.
Now, when you say it's fascistic, I'm curious, did you think it was fascistic the first time, The first term, I mean?
No, I didn't use that term. I don't think too many people did during the first 4 years of Trump being president. He was sort of getting his feet wet by his own account and others. He was, he thinks, mistakenly taking advice from people who, I won't say they were moderate, they were classic right-wingers, and they restrained him, and he didn't seem to have his footing. Now he's got his foot on a lot of people's necks, and he's just deciding that he's going to break every friggin' rule he can. And apparently he can break a lot of them. And an underlying flaw of the U.S. Constitution apparently is that the Congress doesn't have the army, the courts don't have the army, but the president does. So I think this is getting worse and worse, really, by the week.
Yeah. I know that someone who, for instance, like Yanis Varoufakis, whose analysis I like on many things, he's someone who obviously is an economist. So his analysis of fascism includes the economic side of it. And he's someone who didn't think Trump was a fascist the first term and does now. I do think that that's true. I think we're seeing fascistic. I mean, what's so unfortunate is that we can see fascistic elements in both parties. But I'm also not going to pretend that they're the same level of fascist. I think that, as you said, there's a neoliberalism that is very problematic. And then there's fascism that's also problematic. And we'll get into that a bit more. But you've called for a united front to take on Trump. What would this look like? And what would be the role of the Democrats, given that, as you just laid out, they are themselves a problem?
For progressives, yeah, I think it would involve a simultaneous, one might say dialectical, reckoning with where we are in real terms right now. One is that we are up against a fascistic government here in the United States. And so to develop a way to counter it and push back against it and hopefully roll it back, it's going to require progressives, people on the left, to join with other forces that we consider in many ways to be absolutely odious, including the corporatists and the militarists. So on the one hand, we're joining in a united front with them, we hope, and we also are fighting against militarism and corporatism at the same time. And yeah, we don't want to be here, but I think that's where we are. What it might look like remains to be seen. We need to organize. And that is not really in the, so to speak, political DNA of the country. And unfortunately, in recent decades, not particularly among the left in this country. I think you'd have to go back to the 1930s, the labor organizing, the CIO, that really very deep organizing, neighborhood by neighborhood, virtually block by block. So we've got to learn. It's the necessity is the impelling imperative that we're now facing.
Right. So how do we make sure that in this united front that you're proposing, that the more corporatist, militarist wing of this united front doesn't then kind of grab the reins and shape the opposition or define the opposition kind of unilaterally to Trump?
Well, that's a great question. I think that is the situation that we are facing right now. The neoliberals, the militarists, they have a hammerlock on the vast majority of the Democratic Party in Washington, the Democratic National Committee, Democrats in the House and Senate. There's a observation that is ascribed to Malcolm X, who said that if somebody is holding a gun on you and somebody else is trying to poison you, your first job is to knock the gun out of the hand of the person who's holding the gun on you. And certainly neoliberalism and the Democratic Party brand and style and method of corporate militaristic rule, it's poisonous. The fact is, though, as we've been discussing, that not in any of our lifetimes has the assault on what has remained of democracy in this country been so vicious, so unrelenting. And Katie, as you were describing the sort of economic aspects of fascism, it reminds me that a classic core facet of fascism is the unity of the gazillionaires, the corporate forces, and the government. And all you got to do is say two words, Elon Musk, and it illuminates where we are.
Right. Wanted to ask you a related question. You know, speaking of the Democrats, neoliberalism, the failure of the Democrats, the way that they got us into this moment, wanted to ask you your thoughts on this new book by Jake Tapper, which he co-wrote with Alex Thompson from Axios. I want to know your thoughts on this new book that you've reviewed, and then I'm going to ask you to respond to some interesting footage of Jake Tapper himself. But yeah, what are your thoughts on this book?
Yeah, it was rolled out over a period of 3 months, a tremendous drumbeat. I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement to even get a copy. I wrote about it, and The Nation published my piece on Tuesday last week, because hours before that, The New York Times basically jumped the line and broke the embargo. It's all to say that it's a huge commercial enterprise. And I say two cheers for the book, definitely not three, because it exposes just the degree of dissembling, outright lies, deception, shameless eagerness to deceive the people of the United States through the news media in every which way that was pursued relentlessly by the Biden family, by the chiefs of staff and the top aides in the White House, with the direct complicity of top Democratic leaders in Congress like Chuck Schumer. I mean, Schumer should, on the basis of the evidence in the book, be forced to resign, certainly as minority leader of the Senate. It ain't going to happen unless we organize effectively around that, for instance. I think, though, the book really lets the Democrats in Congress off the hook, because it was the silence. Almost all of them were not willing to call out what was hidden in plain sight, which was that Biden was barely competent in his last couple of years, just cognitively, to be president, let alone to run again and ostensibly be president for the last or the next 4 years for his second term. At rootsaction.org, we don't claim to be rocket scientists. We're not claiming to be brilliant. But in November of 2022, we launched the Don't Run Joe campaign. And we could not find one other single sizable national organization to join us. This is the cultural fear, the contagion that still continues. And there's a lot of people now, and I understand they're saying, hey, you know, Trump is evolving into a full-blown dictator. Why are you talking about what happened? Well, like Orwell said, those who control the past control the future. Those who control the present control the past. This pattern of the Democratic Party's so-called leadership is enduring. It is about fear. It is about don't challenge the leadership. We have to be willing and able from the grassroots to insist that Schumer shouldn't be in the leadership. He's discredited. We have Hakeem Jeffries, who right after the inauguration hightailed it to Silicon Valley to tell these gazillionaires there, hey, we're going to move the Democratic Party to the center from where the party is, not that it isn't already dead in the middle of the corporate center to begin with. So these folks are pretty much, I won't say waving a white flag, they're just rhetorically claiming to oppose this Trump dictatorship, and they're not doing a whole hell of a lot.
Right. Let's take a look, by the way, at this. I'm just going to show what this book looks like. So here's the book. I'm showing it on Amazon, which, of course, I don't suggest people use. But here it is. Original Sin, President Biden's Decline, Its Cover-Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. Again, by Jake Tapper. And here's the you can see an image of Biden with someone covering his eyes. The New York Times calls it explosive. The Atlantic says it's the most significant book to date about Biden's cognitive decline, which is kind of a sad thing. It suggests that there's a whole genre of books about Biden's cognitive decline. Superbly reported, reads like a Shakespearean drama on steroids. I think from reading your review, I'm not sure you would give it that amazing a review. But one of the things that you mention is that what you found most shocking was actually what was said about Kamala Harris. So I'm going to just quote your article. You write, perhaps the most noteworthy sentence in Original Sin is the one about Kamala Harris. The issue that she truly and most strongly disagreed with the president on behind closed doors was Israel's war against Hamas and Gaza. That's the quote. That's what the book says. The book says the issue that she truly and most strongly disagreed with the president on behind closed doors was Israel's war against Hamas and Gaza. And then you write, her public echoing of Biden's explanations for huge nonstop weapon shipments to Israel was both morally unconscionable and politically damaging. By a big margin, polls were clear that most Americans wanted to stop arming Israel. So what is the significance of this claim for you?
I think it's about political cowardice and about a culture of our partisan politics in both parties, where looking out for yourself and not wanting to rock any big boats and it would come back on you is really par for the course. And so she's a dramatic example, and I don't think we should be fatalistic about it. It doesn't have to be that way, but it was that way with her. She could have actually spoken out. She declined to do so. And can you imagine, while people in Gaza, men, women, children, so many civilians are being slaughtered and starved, courtesy of U.S. taxpayers, and Kamala Harris has an opportunity to actually depart from the policies and basically, frankly, sucking up to Biden, and she refuses to do so. Something that has emerged was that right before she went into her one debate with Trump, she got a call from Joe Biden, and he said, Kamala, no daylight between us. She was being warned by him, and this is, again, where there are echoes of the past, because Hubert Humphrey, running for president in 1968, was humiliated, was warned by the incumbent president, Lyndon B. Johnson, don't you dare distance from my Vietnam War policy. And he was just chicken shit. He wouldn't buck the president. He was vice president. And so it was all very late in the campaign. He took these mincing steps. Well, Kamala Harris didn't even take mincing steps. And as you alluded to in the passage there about the polling, the polling was obvious. It was by YouGov, a reputable pollster in swing states. If she had spoken out calling for an arms embargo, she would have gotten a lot more votes.
Right. Yeah, we even spoke about it on this show. And I remember asking you, and it's not that easy to calculate, but I was asking kind of devil's advocate, if we knew what the political cost of like upsetting donors and upsetting AIPAC would have been, which is something we still don't know. But I think it's probably, what do you think? I asked you that then. Do you have any new thoughts on this?
Well, that's the calculus that she made consciously or not. I think that there was a lot of fear of her base, which is the punditocracy, the mass media columnists, the commentators, the journalists, people like Jake Tapper and zillions of others and major cable outlets on MSNBC, Morning Joe, and all the rest of them. They were, along with her advisors, down the middle. They said, do not do anything different of substance from Joe Biden. So she would have really angered some of those people, but they don't have a lot of votes. So it's, as they say, counterfactual. We don't know the results, but she'd already at that point raised, by early fall, close to $1 billion with a B dollars, which shows that actually dollars don't vote.
Right. That's true. Yeah, that is a good point. And of course, I'm not defending not doing the right thing on this issue. I'm just curious about if we have any data about how it's, I guess it's hard to quantify the damage that having AIPAC go after you would have done.
Yeah. And part of it is where political analysis and psychoanalysis overlap, because these are folks who raised themselves out through the ranks. They got used to pleasing those who were higher up in the political ladder. And, you know, you think about even now, there's a lot of focus on age. Well, let's face it, you know, Bernie Sanders is Biden's age, and he's totally on it. He's completely sharp like a tack, as the saying goes. So it's not about age. It's about capacity, whether you have the cognitive ability, and what you believe in, or what do you believe in, or does that affect then what you actually do? So we have the House Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries. He's 53 years old, but he might as well be 100 years old, because he rose himself through the ranks by pleasing who? Pleasing Nancy Pelosi. That shows your mentality, and it acculturates you. So that's, I think, what's part of the challenge to transform the hierarchy dominance of a political party, which is it's the psychology too. It's changing a political culture. And that means really calling it out. And that's where, again, why I understand people are saying, let's focus on Trump. He's, you know, he's a absolute historic criminal already. He's a dictator. He's costing so many incalculable lives in domestic program, foreign program, and so forth. I understand people are right that we should be focusing on that. But at the same time, if we don't change the political culture and call it out of the only electoral vehicle, the Democratic Party, with a capacity to defeat these fascistic Republicans in federal elections, then we're going to have them rolled again and again by the fascists.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think it's not looking backwards to try to figure out how to win next time moving forward.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I want to show another quote from the book that you cite. And this is a quote of Schumer. So this is, as you warn against, this is like a fly on the wall quote, and it's not, it doesn't have any attribution, right?
Yeah.
But this is apparently, this is the following was said. Schumer said, "Mr. President, your chances of winning are only 5%. I've talked to your pollsters. I know all three of them, and they think it's a 5% chance. 5%. Biden goes, "Really?" Schumer goes, "Yes, they're Donilon and Rachetti, who are his two of his advisors, are not telling you. The pollsters told me. He's not seen our polls. It all goes to Donilon, and Donilon interprets it. Okay, you have a 5% chance. The analytics guy who probably knows this best said it's 1%. So obviously, as you said, this implicates not just Biden's advisors, but also someone like Chuck Schumer.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And he, of course, publicly was saying that not only Biden was in a strong position, but also he had all of his marbles, which... Right. It's very clear in his last couple of years, he did not. And I think a lot of people are going around and around in their heads and in discourse this week of, well, who do we blame? I mean, if somebody, and many of us have known people who began to suffer from dementia, well, it's an illness. It's a physical impairment. Do we blame Biden? Well, on the one hand, no, because he's impaired. On the other hand, him arming genocide,
yeah, right,
is consistent with 50 years of his politics.
Right. Yes, so he doesn't fit out that. We can't pretend it was dementia that made him arm Israel.
Yeah, exactly, because that's his reflex. And then we go to, okay, the outer circles, which was his, I mean, clearly Jill Biden was crucial to the denial, the family as a whole, then the people who were the chief of staff and so forth. But that's where, I mean, Rich Action took out an ad for Don't Run Joe in early 2023. It was two full-page ads. One of them was Help Wanted. And we were, so to speak, beseeching Democrats in Congress, progressives there, step out, run against Biden. We didn't get any response at all. They were just keeping their heads down.
Right. Well, another person who it's somewhat hypocritical to talk about this issue is Jake Tapper himself. And there's actually a mashup out there of Jake Tapper, who's running the kind of interference that he's criticizing others for running. So let's take a look at this mashup.
I think it makes little kids with stutters feel when they see you make a comment like that.
It's very clearly a cognitive decline.
Okay.
That's what I'm referring to. It makes me uncomfortable.
This is so amazing. It's so amazing to me that
and try and figure out an answer.
A cognitive decline.
President Biden embraces his stutter, talking about it, while Trump mocks it, exaggerates it, belittles it. He's sharp physically. I mean, mentally.
Yeah.
I think the question is physically, right?
Right.
More so?
Right.
Right. And the guy who's his chief opponent is only 3 or 4 years younger than him.
Exactly.
I mean, you have questioned President Biden's age, mental fitness, ability to lead. Of those supporting Biden, you said, quote, shame.
That's Dean Phillips, by the way, the like radically moderate who wanted to take on Biden.
This ability to lead. Of those supporting Biden, you said, quote, shame on all of you pretending everything is okay. You're leading us and him into a disaster. Do you worry that you damaged him at all? I don't doubt that you got hugs and handshakes behind closed doors today. And maybe even publicly, some of them, because they like you personally. But I've heard a lot of really nasty stuff about you from your Democratic colleagues.
Sure.
I mean, just like, what is he thinking? Exercise in narcissism. I mean, false claims to the walls.
Does he not see the exercise in narcissism that was coming from the president?
One would wish.
Street Journal about President Biden's mental fitness and acuity. He's 81 and his memory, you know, it doesn't seem great. It's not horrible, but I don't understand the outrage. Quote, behind closed doors, Biden shows signs of slipping, unquote. The Wall Street Journal is owned by News Corp, which is run by the Murdochs. Beyond the headline, there is some critical nuance here. The article is mostly based on observations of Republicans, with former Speaker Kevin McCarthy the only one going on the record. They do note in the article that most of the criticism comes from Republicans. Have you heard any concerns from anyone who has met with President Biden about him seeming a little slower?
No.
The Russians are trying to do to make us and the public not trust our election integrity. Joe Biden has dementia, all this stuff.
So there you have it. So, Norman, you are a media analyst as well. So can you talk to us about why it was that Jake Tapper was part of this chorus of cover-up that he's now indicting?
Yeah, his attack on the Wall Street Journal is just a typical of the herd mentality. Here, a media outlet actually did thorough reporting. This was before the catastrophic debate, and it was solid. And so the hay that Tapper was making out of it all was, A, that Rupert Murdoch, the right-winger, owns the Wall Street Journal, but the craziness there is on the editorial page. And when you're an investor, you're not going to sustain or support or really, in a sense, allow the Wall Street Journal to just make stuff up on the news page because you're investing on that basis. So the reporting was very solid, as it often is in the Wall Street Journal. That was a very, very well-grounded story and expose. So what Tapper does, and he seemed to be in an irony-free zone. There weren't Democrats who were on the record there. I wonder why, because actually they were too cowardly, because the entire culture and herd mentality of Democrats in Congress was pretend that everything's fine. And so the net result is you have a party ethos that is, ironically, in the name of defeating Trump, actually helping to elect Trump.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. And can you elaborate more on that for people who don't already see that connection?
Look, and I talked to a congressperson who told me this early on. Look, we know that he is essentially not all there mentally. But if we acknowledge that, then that's going to help to elect Trump. So we'd better just hunker down and pretend everything's fine. So let's assume, and I think it was the motivation, we're going to cover up for Biden because we want to defeat Trump. But by covering up for Biden, it actually made it possible for Biden to file for re-election and keep running until it was too late for the party to have any contested primaries and have somebody run the gauntlet and be vetted and so forth by voters who could have run a strong campaign and quite possibly defeated Trump. And we had the experience at Roots Action. We were going to Democratic National Committee meetings with flyers. When the DNC met in Philadelphia, the full 450 of them, we hired a huge billboard truck to circle around the hotel where the DNC met. And it said, "Don't run Joe." And we explained why. But that's sort of like a heretic at the devout convention. Sam Rosenthal, our political director who was there, he was scorned, he was mocked, he was laughed at. He was told, "Hey, you're just going to help Trump this way."
Well, you know, you point out in your review that people like AOC and Bernie, and you were a Bernie, surrogate and delegate.
Well, I was a delegate twice in 2016 and 2020.
Yeah. So you point out that they actually weren't better than the centrists in pushing Biden.
They weren't. As a matter of fact, Pamela Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, endorsed Biden 2 years before the 2024 general election. Then the next year, it was, among others, AOC and Bernie Sanders. And then, and I think this is the worst part, down to the day that Biden withdrew from the 2024 race, AOC and Bernie Sanders were adamantly stating that he should complete the campaign for 2024 for president. And it was just astonishing to me. And I think it goes to how pervasive this go along to get along with the party hierarchy is. Again, this is an irony. It's kind of, Katie, like we were talking about a couple of minutes ago. In the name of, hey, we've got to hunker down and say that Biden's okay, they actually enabled him or encouraged him to just keep going and not quit until it got even worse. There were fewer and fewer days. Turned out only 107 before Kamala Harris had election day between her declaration of candidacy and when the votes were in.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that a lot of people who don't want to look back at what happened are obviously have a vested interest in not looking back because that would require some introspection and criticism. I remember like recently I was on some listserv and someone emailed the listserv and they said that they had some role in the Harris campaign and that they were trying to warn people about the mistake in going kind of like Cheney, like the Cheney route to try to win the elections. Yeah. And someone is like, and they're very much like, this is not about blaming. This is about accountability and moving forward. And someone on the listserv was like, stop it. This is how they win when we attack each other. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, how can you be so blind to this? But we see that this is happening still. And, you know, I don't mean to pick on this person because I don't think he's like the most powerful person in the world, but he is someone who did rapid response for Kamala. And I just think it's just so telling that we can't not take a look at this. So yeah, here is actually...
I would say that kind of response is sort of like de facto saying, hey, well, let's keep making the same mistakes over and over. Why not? Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so here is a write-up of this. This is by Wally Shahid, who writes at his Substack, ignored by the party, blamed for its defeat. So this is an article about the way that some of Harris's people are not only not taking any responsibility, but blaming people like the uncommitted for costing them the election. So someone named Amar Musa, who did rapid response for Kamala, he tweeted out an article breaking the Trump administration is working on a plan to permanently relocate up to 1 million Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to Libya. Five people with knowledge of the effort told NBC News. So obviously that's an attempt at ethnic cleansing. And so the response from Amar Musa was CC uncommitted movement. Obviously suggesting, thanks, guys, this is your fault. Hope you're happy now. And then this very same person has the gall to say, our campaign bent over backwards to accommodate them being the uncommitted movement. The VP broke with Biden on Gaza. She met them. Senior leadership met with them. And this is, I mean, as I pointed out and others pointed out, Mehdi Hasan responded. And Mehdi Hasan was someone who's very much vote Biden over Trump. And he said, sorry, Amar, this is total BS. Your campaign refused to allow a Palestinian lawmaker offered by uncommitted to be on stage at the DNC. The vice president refused to break with Biden on Gaza. And when asked what she'd have done differently to him, she said, there's not a thing that comes to mind. Again, a lot of people I know watching this have don't agree with Mehdi's politics, but I don't think anything that he said there is anything but true. And yeah, there's a lot of, again, covering up. So Amar Musa writes, I guess, in response to a Waleed Shahid tweet. So Shahid writes, there's a genre of Democratic operative who spent the last year gaslighting the public and covering up Biden's decline, who now only invokes Palestinians not to mourn with them, but to mock them. It's a cynical hackery at its worst. Divisive and self-sabotaging. And so he's referring to the Amar Musa tweet where Amar CC'd the uncommitted movement. So his response is, there's a genre of Dem operative who cares more about clout chasing than winning elections. While he led a campaign to persuade voters, Kamala Harris would have treated Palestine the same as Trump. He knew that was a lie, but he couldn't stop because it had damaged his business. Yeah, I mean, Brian O'Donnell, another good response. The uncommitted movement made incredibly clear that they wanted to vote for Biden and Harris, but the campaign chose not to engage. You can't actively reject your voters' values and still expect them to show up. Matt Duss, who worked for Bernie, this is a blatantly dishonest description of the uncommitted movement, but it's apparently one that a number of party hacks have decided to push. It couldn't be more obvious that the clout-chasing accusation is actually a confession. And then I just want to quote one more person, Barak Ravid, who is an Israeli-American journalist at Axios. Democratic mega donor Haim Saban wrote an email to Biden's aides, Steve Ricchetti and Anita Dunn, about Biden's decision to put on hold a weapons shipment to Israel. Quote, let's not forget there are more Jewish voters who care about Israel than Muslim voters who care about Hamas, which is like the most offensive framing in the first place.
Yeah, it's sickening. And Chaim Saban is somebody who was going nuts because Biden did this very brief hold on 2,000-pound bombs. The fact is that Kamala Harris made a decision in her presidential campaign last year. It was immoral, and it politically helped to sink her campaign. And to rewrite that now and pretend that the polling wasn't there and it was available at the time, actually, and then just say, oh, let's blame anti-war people. Let's blame them because they didn't want to see little children blown up courtesy of U.S. taxpayers. That's really what they're saying. And we have a right, a responsibility, and you might say the ultimate duty to say, look, history matters. It's not just in the dustbin. Unless we can call this out and change it, it's going to happen again and again.
Right.
Hey, Katie, do you mind if I just interject really quickly?
No.
I just wanted to, I know it wasn't part of the rundown, but I found this video, Norman. I don't know if you recall this. This is from 2022, Joe Biden.
There was a four-lane highway that was accessible. My mother drove us, and rather than us be able to walk. And guess what? The first frost, you know what was happening. You had to put on your windshield wipers to get literally the oil slick off the window. That's why I and so damn many other people I grew up have cancer. And why can't for the longest time, Delaware had the highest cancer rate in the nation.
So this is just me speculating, obviously, but that was from 2022. And to me, that sounds kind of like an unintentional moment of honesty of him saying that he has cancer. And if that's correct, then, you know, in the intervening time when there could have been open primaries and things like that, all of the people that you had mentioned, from Jill Biden to the chief of staff to any of these operatives, made the decision to, you know, knowing that that was his health condition, continued to make sure that that wasn't possible. And as you were saying, then at this late date, continue then to focus on trying to blame, you know, this group or that group or that group instead of like where the blame should matter. And it's just so incredibly frustrating. And it just seems like it's taking the energy away from where it should be.
Well, I don't think we know when he got the cancer diagnosis, but we do know, as you said, that the energy is being taken away from where it should be, both because of the focus on, oh, exactly how demented, so to speak, was he at one time, but also because the Democratic Party itself has leadership that's tangling itself in knots and pretzels right now because they can't own up. I mean, there are some exceptions. A few members of Congress, Ro Khanna was a surrogate. He said, look, last week, he said, we made a mistake. And unless we acknowledge the mistake, we're going to have to face the fact that we'll just be in essentially, he didn't put it this way, but I would call it a repetition compulsion disorder. But that's very different than Chuck Schumer, who's been confronted at least twice on CNN in recent days on this question. And both times he said, let's move forward. That's his answer because he got that scripted by the damage control people.
Like it's like the Obama refusing to, prosecute Bush, saying we're looking forward, not backward.
Yeah, you know what I'm waiting for is the shoplifters and the armed robbers and the people who were squatters and those who were accused of stealing cars. They go into court and the prosecutors say, well, let's look forward, not backward. You're free.
That was in the past, Norman. You know,
Sure.
Anyway, thank you.
Well, speaking of Biden and Gaza, I think it is really important for people to remember that, again, it was more important for Biden and for Kamala, who was not a powerless, agency-free victim, to respect Biden's legacy and norms, because she also didn't want to offend him by deviating from him. Like the same people who were calling Trump an existential threat and saying this election was the most important election ever, those same people thought that it was more important to not offend Biden and not damage his legacy than it was to defeat Trump. So I don't know how anyone can be blaming the voters as opposed to the actual candidates.
Yeah. I mean, if the Democratic Party so-called leadership doesn't like the voters, I don't think they get to elect some new ones. These are people in the country, and we're way more perceptive about Biden's condition. I mean, 37% in one poll, 37% was all of Democrats who wanted Biden to run for re-election before he announced that he would do it again. So the voters, you know, two-thirds of them basically were saying, don't run Joe, lowercase, don't run Joe. And so it's really this elitist policy. We have these pundits, we have the inner circle of New York Times, Washington Post, the networks, and we have the big money people. And one little anecdote quickly is that when Bernie's forces were at high ebb in 2017, there was the Unity Reform Commission of the DNC. I went to some of those meetings, and the Clinton people had, the Hillary Clinton folks had like 55%, and Bernie people had 45%. And Jim Zogby, a great progressive leader, had presented at that meeting one resolution after another. We need financial transparency. We need to know how the money is being spent, who it's going to, at what rate, for what purpose. And those resolutions were voted down again and again. Jen O'Malley Dillon was the chair of that Unity Reform Commission. She ran the show. She helped torpedo all of those proposals that were common sense transparency. What happens to her? She becomes deputy chief of staff of the White House. Then she runs the Biden reelection campaign. Then she runs the Harris campaign. Well, her buddies are making out like bandits. You know, you can't raise and spend more than $1 billion with a B in a few months and not just be lining a lot of pockets. So, of course, they would rather win than lose. But in a financial sense, they never lose.
Right. I wanted to also show a video of Bernie Sanders, who was just on the Flagrant podcast, which is, I guess, a more right-wing platform. And he was asked about Democrats being a threat to democracy. So let's take a listen to what Bernie's response was to that.
I think a lot of voters had is like, they didn't even know if it was her. We didn't even know if Biden was president. We didn't even know if these were her talking points. And we felt that over the last four elections, Democrats, we felt that we didn't have a say on who could be president. We talk a lot about the Republicans being autocrats and oligarchs and taking over democracy. But from the Democrat perspective, and I'm a lifelong Democrat, I felt like the Democratic Party completely removed the democratic process from its constituents. And I think they need to have some accountability of that.
No argument here.
I donated for you. I mean, I wanted you to, like, 2016, I was like, this is going to happen. This guy's going to do it. And it felt like they stole it from you. And I'll be honest, it broke my heart when you supported him.
Look, but you have, in the world that I live in, you got a choice. And, I mean, a lot of people, including my wife, agree with you. But, you know, you're down to a choice. Is it going to be Hillary Clinton or is it going to be Donald Trump? Not a great choice.
But ended up being him anyway, so why don't we burn it down?
Well, because it's easy to say, burning it down means that children are not going to have, you know, food to eat, that the schools will deteriorate, people will not have health care.
I got it.
And I, you know, I'm an elected official, I got to represent the people.
That's fair.
And I can't turn my back on.
But then could we not also say, if ostensibly there hasn't been a fair primary for the Democrats since 2008, are they not also a threat to democracy? Yes. We often hear...
Fair enough. That is, yeah, I'm not going to argue with that point.
So I thought that was interesting, because he doesn't argue with the claim that Democrats are a threat to democracy.
It was, I think, very, very, very interesting. A couple points I would make is, first, that when it comes down to, when it is really a binary choice between a Harris and a Trump, I think people who describe themselves on the left and say it doesn't matter, that's completely wrong. And practically, as a practical matter, intended or not, it is elitist. When you get down to a fascistic Republican Party or a Democrat who's going to be in the White House, this is a delusionary strain on the left that's wrong. And we're dealing with, I'm not going to blame the left because it's corporate America that was responsible, but we can't build good analysis and dialectical politics by pretending that the Republican and Democratic parties are the same. The other thing I want to say in response to that video is that when Bernie, who I think is just a wonderful leader on the whole, while I disagree with him on occasion, when he says that these primaries were run by the Democratic Party in ways that did not allow voters to make their choice, in 2024, he was a factor in that problem. Because he was an enabler for Biden publicly because he personally liked him and he'd made a calculus. We have to get away from personal loyalty. It's not about Biden, Bernie, or anybody else. I don't care about their own life more than I care about the checker who I know at the supermarket. We have to stop worrying about these individuals and their loyalties and start having real democracy. And that means a fight.
Yeah. I think that I know a lot of people watching now are very, really feel like either there isn't a significant difference or there is a difference, but we have to burn it down, or they couldn't bring themselves to vote for Harris. I think that there's no question that Trump is worse than Harris. I think that I just can't bring myself to blame people who felt like they couldn't vote for Harris. I think that there was a teeny bit of a chance that Trump was maybe going to be better on certain issues like Russia, Ukraine, maybe even on Israel for the totally incorrect reasons, like because of narcissism or real estate deals. And even I got a little bit excited last week. I thought he was going to maybe actually like stick it to Israel a little bit again, not because he cares about Palestinians, but out of kind of ego and wanting to like discipline Netanyahu. But what I do think is true is that we do have to be honest about we're in, this is really not exciting. And I'm sure I'm not going to get a lot of like thumbs up or clicks for saying this, but you know, we don't have a viable third party. We don't have a good Democratic Party. I don't know what the answer is right now, except, I do think that, you know, certain things that are positive, we're seeing that people are out on the streets for Palestine. Of course, the policy hasn't changed, but as I often will point out, you don't get the policy changes until you get the shift in public opinion, right? So it's what we're seeing now is necessary, but insufficient. But I wanted to actually ask you about, and I wish I had some big, you know, grand plan for moving forward. I think that unfortunately, like, I don't think that the Democrats learn a lesson. I don't think it's like, oh, they didn't vote for them because of genocide, and now they're going to know that they can't support genocide anymore. I just don't think that's going to be the takeaway. But I actually want to ask you about, if you could just kind of end on discussing how the media has enabled the slaughter of Palestinians, the genocide of Palestinians, because this is something you talk about a lot. And also, you have a really fascinating piece on J Street and what an abomination J Street was. And I have to admit, you know, I'm not a liberal Zionist. I think that liberal Zionism is inherently problematic. I personally think that people who are liberal Zionists are reachable in ways, perhaps, that right-wing Zionists are not reachable. That's kind of a slightly different discussion. Tell us what you found about J Street, and then talk about the role of the media in enabling this genocide. J Street is kind of like presents itself as the liberal answer to AIPAC, right? And they're pro-peace.
Yes, they call themselves pro-Israel, pro-peace, which has clearly, to anyone watching, been an oxymoron and very much aligned with the Democratic Party. Credit where due, they fought for the Iran nuclear deal. They're fighting for another Iran nuclear deal. But J Street representing sort of an example, an incarnation of, as you say, liberal Zionism, wants to hold on to a dream that has sailed. That ship has sailed a long time ago, probably in 1948, but certainly it is an ongoing effort to square a circle. And what I found in writing about J Street for The Nation a couple of months ago was I went through at that point 130 different news releases from J Street between the fall of 2023 and this spring. They absolutely refused to acknowledge that Israel is engaged in genocide in Gaza, whereas Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International have documented it unequivocally. And J Street also has never been willing to call for an arms embargo against Israel while it continues the genocide. And so when we see, yes, there's all sort of, I don't doubt, sincere anguish that J Street leaders and members express about the suffering in Gaza, to be really candid, I believe that J Street represents a current of Jewish attitude in the United States that is anti-AIPAC, but also puts Jewish lives at a higher value than Palestinian lives. That's called racism. It's called ethnocentrism. You can call it whatever you want, but right now it is enabling genocide.
Were you, by the way, ever a Zionist? Were you raised as a Zionist? You come from a Zionist family?
Tacitly, when I was 12 and 13 years old and given a blue and white can to go and collect some coins for a tree in Israel, I sort of assumed that. But I broke with that in 1982 with the bombing of Beirut. And one of the things I'm more pleased by in my particular writing history is that Abe Foxman from ADL wrote a letter to editors of newspapers denouncing me in that year because of my article saying Israel is slaughtering innocent people in Lebanon. And I would just sort of, in a sense, sum up in this way. At that point, I was in a household with a peace advocate who worked for a peace and social justice organization. And she and I were reading the newspaper of the slaughter in Lebanon, in Beirut, the Shabra and Shatila massacres by the Israelis and their allies. And she was sobbing and she said, "I can't speak out against Israel because I'll get fired." And this was an employee of a peace and justice organization. So I feel so angry still about this in the present day, but also I feel a lot of hope because of organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now, because we just have to fight back.
Right. Yeah. And final question for you is just if you could just share with people your insights into how the media, I mean, you wrote an entire book about this, but how the media has enabled genocide in Gaza.
Tacitly and often explicitly, it's what lives really matter and what lives don't. And the empathetic coverage, for instance, of civilians who are killed by Russian bombs in Ukraine, that's what journalism should strive to do. But there's very little of that coverage in the last year and a half, that empathetic coverage in U.S. media about the U.S. taxpayer-funded genocide and slaughter and maiming and terrorism by the Israeli government in Gaza. And there's a paradigm there. Even when the coverage is empathetic, it's victims without victimizers. It shows you the suffering of an individual family. They're victims, but somehow it just sort of happens. The bombs fell from the sky. Who dropped the bombs? Who paid for the bombs? And that's the distinction. There are victimizers. They're at the top of the Israeli government. They're at the top of the U.S. government. And when news media in the U.S., as they almost always do in mass media, evade that reality, then they are lying.
Right. So any kind of like things that people should be on the lookout for? It sounds like it's the word choice, right? Like slaughter, active voice versus passive voice, attributing it to people. So the Russians do this versus Palestinians are killed or Palestinians die. Yeah.
Yes, very much the adjectives used, the empathetic ones, the condemning words, the compassionate words, and also the silences are also extremely powerful. And so it's almost as though this suffering, which is just so horrific, according to the news media, Gaza, according to the U.S. media, it's just sort of is happening and disconnected from who's paying for the bombs, who's shipping the bombs, who's dropping them.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Norman. Everyone should check out Norman's work. Go to his website. He's very prolific. And anything else that you want to plug that you're working on?
For sure. We're doing a lot of organizing on these issues at rootsaction.org. And if you're not getting action alerts, please go to rootsaction.org and we'll be in touch.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Norman.
Thank you, Katie.
Have a great night. Thank you, everyone who's watching. We've only just begun. We have a whole other segment that we're going to bring on right now. I'm really excited. We have someone who's making their debut at the Katie Halper Show. That's Ken McCarthy. We also have someone who's returning, and that is Aaron Good. But before we bring them on, we are going to play part of this, a very kind of disturbing video, I have to admit. It's of Smotrich on aid and annihilation of Gaza, basically. And I think it's really important to watch because this explains why Israel is letting in the minuscule amount of aid that they're letting in. So this is a statement from Smotrich. Again, that is Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich. So let's take a listen. And Brad, you can play it from the very beginning, and then we're probably going to focus on a little bit, a mini portion of it. Okay. So just go full screen, please, for this.
All right. I just need 1 second to pull up the full.
You already cut it down?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. The problem is Brad's an overachiever, so of course he did the something it great. Is. Well, you can play the cancer video.
It's my cross to bear.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Just one moment, please.
Okay. Oh yeah. So you can access the full one.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Great. And in the meantime, here, look. You wouldn't know, but look who's on my lap right now.
Oh my God.
He just jumped up. He just jumped up.
His face will never not make me laugh.
Oh, also give a like. Where are we on likes? Can someone tell me where we are on likes? In fact, I should look at that. Someone wrote Brad is a gem. Brad, you shouldn't write and pretend to be someone else.
Thanks for blowing up my spot there, Katie. Where are we at? Let's see.
Look at this face.
Oh, wow. 422 likes. Thanks.
All right, well, let's get it up.
436. Thank you so much,
let's get everyone. It up higher. I mean, we're at 648 viewers. We should be at least at 500. All right, so Brad, do you have that video yet? I know I just gave you a bunch of stuff to do.
Yeah, no, I haven't.
Okay, great. So let's full screen it, and then we will be back, and I'll bring on our next guests, Aaron Good and Ken McCarthy. Thank you so much.
What will come in the coming days is the bare minimum. A few bakeries distributing pitas to people, public kitchens providing daily serving of cooked food. Civilians in Gaza will receive a pita and a plate of food, and that's it. That's exactly what we see in the video. People standing in line, waiting for someone to ladle them a bowl of soup. This does not reach Hamas. And it allows civilians to eat, and our friends in the world to continue providing us with international protection against the Security Council and The Hague, and for us to continue fighting with God's help until victory. All attempts to evade responsibility and to pass the decision from one to another are childish and the farthest thing from leadership. What I would want to avoid the need to bring aid into the Gaza Strip altogether, even not to civilians. I understand the anger very well. I understand the stomach pains. We all feel as citizens. The truth is that until the last hostage returns, even if we shouldn't give to the Gaza Strip, but in reality, if we act this way, the world will force us to stop the war in a moment and lose. It's winning the battle and losing the war. I am committed to winning the war, factually. And pay attention to this point. For a year and a half, we've been hitting Hamas hard. We are dismantling Gaza and leaving it in ruins with unprecedented destruction in the world. The world has not stopped us yet. There are pressures. There are those who attack. They try to stop us. They are not succeeding. Do you know why they're not succeeding? Because we're navigating wisely and responsibly, and we will continue to do so.
I'm going to bring on our next guests, and that is obviously a very disturbing video, and Smotrich is an absolutely disgusting person, and we're going to talk more about him, especially because our next segment is going to look at the relationship between Israel and JFK, and to do that, we are bringing on two great guests, as I said, bringing back onto the show Aaron Good, who is a political scientist and historian and the host of the American Exception podcast and the author of American Exception, Empire and the Deep State. And making his debut on the Katie Halper Show, we are bringing on Ken McCarthy, who's the author of JFK and RFK's Secret Battle Against Zionist Extremism, the documentary evidence, and John F. Kennedy, Anti-Imperialist, His Character and Intentions, revealed in 5 speeches and 1 telegram. So welcome, Aaron and Ken.
Hey.
Hi, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So wanted to start off with asking you, I mean, why is JFK an important subject today?
Well, he's, of all the presidents we've had in the last 60 plus years, he remains the most popular. And he was murdered in broad daylight. And somehow we still can't get closure on who did it, which is mind-boggling. And he had a relationship with Israel that has been, the details of which have been thoroughly suppressed. I mean, it is the big dark hole in American history. And it's amazing, 60 years, they're willing to admit the CIA was involved. They're willing to admit all kinds of things. They don't want to talk about JFK's attitude towards Israel. So it's a good topic. But it's something I want, if I may just talk, respond to the clip that you just showed earlier. If I could give a historical context, and this will come back around and bring us back to JFK. The Zionists in the 1930s were very happy to be known as fascist Zionists or Zionist fascists. Now, obviously, that's not a popular term anymore. But in the 1930s, it was, didn't have a bad rep. They were proud to be fascists. Now, here's where it gets relevant. They admired Mussolini a lot. And they admired Mussolini in particular because they liked the way he handled the Ethiopians. And Mussolini was one of the first people, one of the first monsters to do aerial bombardment of civilians. And the Zionists thought that was cool. And they actually went to Italy in large numbers. And they were befriended by Mussolini. And he actually admitted 100 of them, give or take, to the Italian Naval Academy to be trained in military operations. So these guys have been fascists and murderers from the beginning. So we're just seeing what we're seeing today. This is what Mussolini would be doing. You know, and there would be,
I mean, way worse than what Mussolini would be doing. Yeah,
and there'd be elements in the Italian population, not all of them, who'd be cheering.
Right.
So that's a little background to our Zionist friends and their roots.
Yeah. What do you think, Aaron?
Well, I would say that he was, as you say, the most popular president by Gallup poll numbers. He had the highest average popularity rating. And then he was assassinated by the regime that we live under, which is pretty obvious because they've stonewalled so long for this. It's just, we're all pretending like, oh, it's a mystery. Are we going to know who did it? But in the bigger sense, we know that the regime... Yeah, I mean, the regime did it. The problem is we don't really understand the kind of regime that we have, because if it's lawful and democratic and transparent, then that does not go along with, you know, what happened in Dallas in 1963. But looking back at what the Kennedy brothers were facing in that term, there is the criminal aspect of the United States as the global empire, the hegemon of global capitalism. And that is a role that cannot really be played without a whole lot of criminality. And in the CIA, they essentially gave themselves, and presidents, you know, availed them of this when it was expedient, they gave themselves the power to be above the law. And Arthur Schlesinger, under one of the new documents declassified, said, is from Arthur Schlesinger. And he was sort of the court historian of JFK's administration. He's a former OSS guy, not somebody that I am particularly fond of, but he's a liberal. He's a Cold War liberal. And he said that the CIA, at the time, he wanted a big reorganization of the CIA after the Bay of Pigs. And he said the CIA is taking on all the characteristics of a state within a state. And what I have found recently, and I'm really building on the work of Peter Dale Scott, because he's the sort of master intellectual of this era, who was a great scholar, historian, social scientist, and poet, and a professor at Berkeley, who really made an astounding number of discoveries. So I don't want to be putting forward some of this baseline information and just pretending that I just discovered all this myself, you know, because that's a common thing in the internet age. But Peter, if you read Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, I read it in 2010 the first time, and I have to admit that a lot of it was over my head. But when he was writing about the crime syndicate, and knowing Peter, because I've become good friends with him, I've done this you know, 40-hour oral history project with him and co-written articles with him. And I'm trying to edit a book of his essays, maybe the last one of political writings of his. So I'm very close to Peter. But I know that he, when it comes to Israel, he would not say things so explicitly. But if you go back and you read Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, you surmise that the Italian model of the organized crime syndicate, you know, is this like Italian thing, and like it's these Italian mobsters, La Cosa Nostra. This is something that the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and the FBI, they only admitted this kind of grudgingly in the 50s, but it was really much more than this. It was really more run by Lansky out of Vegas. And it also relied on the nationwide network of the Teamster Union. And Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa, and Meyer Lansky were both Mossad assets, essentially. They both were involved in shipping arms to Israel in 1948. And they, you know, Hoffa visited Israel a number of times. Jimmy Hoffa Jr., like, he either runs or is a part of the Yitzhak Rabin Foundation today. I mean, this is a history that we have kind of forgotten. We've forgotten who Hoffa was and how RFK went after him. And RFK was unique in going after the syndicate. He went after the Vegas crowd, which was, again, the recipient. They built up Las Vegas in the 40s to be a conduit for drug money out of a connection set up in Mexico by Meyer Lansky. And what you could call the Jewish mob. And this is really the source of what Las Vegas is. And then Teamster loans to build up casinos. And it's this massive money laundering center. There's a really good book by Sally Denton and Roger Morris on this also called, I think, The Money and the Power. And it's about Vegas. But you fast forward to today, and let me get back to the CIA within a CIA idea, Ken. And I think that you'll appreciate this. You not only had the CIA back then as a state within a state, but you had within the CIA, James Angleton and his connection to Mossad, because he handled the Mossad account, which was a CIA within the CIA within the state. I mean, it was like a state within a state within a state. It was like and it was tied to the crime syndicate, which was protected not just by James Angleton in counterintelligence, because he did stop an investigation into some money laundering that the Kennedys requested. But also, Lansky was protected by J. Edgar Hoover and Harry Anslinger, the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. So essentially, you had this network protected by the highest echelons of the national security state that protected the organized crime syndicate, and which was functionally a Mossad asset as well, which had implications in that they controlled the National Racing Wire Service, for example. And this was a kind of network of corruption and political corruption throughout the entire country that was essentially put to the service of Mossad if and when it needed to influence American politics. And so this is quite insane. And we all know about the mob, you know, the Lansky mob, CIA plots, people like Rosselli, who ran the wire service for Lansky and Annenberg out in L.A. at the Santa Anita racetrack. I mean, we know about and Robert Mayhew and how these people had these plots with the CIA to try to kill Castro. And this was a big scandal. But if you fast forward to today, you know, when they wanted to go after Assange in 2020, there's this Gray Zone article that says when they went after Assange, who did the CIA do to plan his assassination attempt, which they didn't carry out, thankfully, but also to illegally surveil him? This emerged in Spanish court that the person that the CIA used was Sheldon Adelson and his casino company, which is the biggest contributor to the Republican Party, using casino money from Macau. A lot of it is the Sands company, which is an old Lansky outfit from at Las Vegas. And this is all these years later. It's this, we have outsourced a lot of things to Israel. Epstein is another example. It seems the CIA outsourced the sexual blackmail aspect of its operations to Epstein, and that would likely be why he was protected. So Israel is a part of this dark criminal state within a state within a state that is a part of our regime that we just don't understand. And it's really staggering to think of the implications of it. And the once JFK was assassinated, RFK never again met with his organized crime unit, because I think he knew that the mobsters had won. And this is really, the U.S. became pretty much a criminal enterprise full stop after that, because nobody could stand up to these people anymore.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. And this is, by the way, some of the, if you're watching live, you're in luck, because it's all obviously, none of this is paywalled when you watch live. Some of this will be Patreon only, but we'll have a full discussion with you guys that's also available. No one should feel deprived. So this, I want to make sure what we're about to say is not Patreon, because I think it's really important. So there's this claim that Trump is anti-deep state. And we've talked about this a little bit, Aaron. I don't think that most people who watch my show think that. But I have to admit, I was a little bit suckered last week. I thought, I got a little excited. I thought that Trump was maybe going to do some stuff to piss off Netanyahu. Again, not because he has any morals or cares about Palestinians, but out of, I think I said this earlier to Norman Solomon, right? Out of a sense of kind of like narcissism, wanting to look like he's the boss, wanting to look like he calls the shots. It is always, I do think it's weird that whenever I remember that BB gave Trump a golden beeper, because obviously that was supposed to be like a fancy gift, but it also is a kind of weird symbolism since they used beepers to kill people. But I definitely got my hopes up a little bit. Also, because Trump likes to talk anti-intervention. And of course, I never bought into that. I know he's smart enough to talk like he's an anti-interventionist. So I want to show a clip of a recent speech that Trump gave during his trip to the Middle East. Have you guys respond to it? And then we're going to contrast that to what's actually happening in the Middle East.
The transformations have been unbelievably remarkable. Before our eyes, a new generation of leaders is transcending the ancient conflicts of tired divisions of the past and forging a future where the Middle East is defined by commerce, not chaos, where it exports technology, not terrorism, and where people of different nations, religions, and creeds are building cities together, not bombing each other out of existence. We don't want that.
So now we see Mohammed bin Salman, who, of course, has bombed the people of Yemen, clapping. That's sweet.
And it's crucial for the wider world to note this great transformation has not come from Western interventionists or flying people in beautiful planes giving you lectures on how to live and how to govern your own affairs. No, the gleaming marvels of Riyadh and Abu Dhabi were not created by the so-called nation builders, neocons, or liberal nonprofits like those who spent trillions and trillions of dollars failing to develop Kabul, Baghdad, so many other cities. Instead, the birth of a modern Middle East has been brought by the people of the region themselves, the people that are right here, the people that have lived here all their lives, developing your own sovereign countries, pursuing your own unique visions and charting your own destinies in your own way. It's really incredible what you've done. In the end, the so-called nation builders wrecked far more nations than they built, and the interventionists were intervening in complex societies that they did not even understand themselves. They told you how to do it, but they had no idea how to do it themselves. Peace, prosperity, and progress ultimately came not from a radical rejection of your heritage, but rather from embracing your national traditions and embracing that same heritage that you love so dearly.
Katie, can I just say, I didn't notice this earlier, but if we go back to where we see Bin Salman for the first time, is that Elon Musk sitting next to him?
Yeah, it is.
Speaking about anti-interventionism, I just wanted to remind the audience of the time that someone being critical of interventionism against Evo Morales in Bolivia, and Elon Musk replying, "We will coup whoever we want, deal with it." I think that's kind of ironic.
Yeah. He would claim it was ironic too, but in a different way. But yes, yeah, he definitely is not. Yeah. So again, this is great talk. When he talks about people's heritage and being allowed to continue their heritage, obviously that doesn't count for Palestinians. But I did want to just kind of, and you know, he said that what is it, Gaza? The people in Gaza are starving, and we're going to stop that. We're going to fix that. Now, of course, they're not starving. I mean, that makes it sound like there's some kind of natural disaster, right? They're being starved to death. Just what's happening right now. So the Kamal Adwan Hospital was put out of service from bombardment by quadcopter machine guns, as reported by DropSite News. There's a trickle of aid coming in, but it'll be barely adequate. And none of it has been distributed to the people of Gaza yet. And according to Gaza government statistics reported by Al Jazeera, at least 326 people have died of malnutrition since March 2nd. UN humanitarian chief Tom Fletcher announced today that if sufficient aid is not allowed into Gaza by Israel during the next 48 hours, 14,000 children could die. So basically what he's saying there is we know that these civilians should be starved to death, but if we do that, then they may undermine our war a little bit. So he's basically just saying, you know, we need to let in some food just so that we are able to not be blocked by the Security Council, and also just so people will continue to arm us. So this is Trump, who said he's going to fix it. They're basically saying out loud how Trump and much of the Western world is interacting with Israel. Now, what's interesting is that some Western nations are actually starting to change, not in any real policy way, but we see some rhetorical shifts. So here is a clip of Adam Bowler, Trump's special envoy for hostage affairs. And here's what he just had to say at a Jerusalem Post conference in response to the UK, France, and Canada's call to break the starvation siege and end the military campaign. Let's take a listen.
So after a few days in Doha, you were there last week with the negotiations team. We're in the midst of a new attempt. How close would you say are we to a new hostage deal?
I'm not going to speak on things that, first of all, some that I was part of, some that I wasn't part of. So I don't want to overspeak. And I think a lot of those things are fluid and confidential. So let me just speak generally in this area, which is I do think we're closer than we ever were. And part of that is because of movement that the IDF and Israel did on the ground. And so that does, it strengthens our hand.
So as opposed to France, the UK, and what was the other country?
Canada,
who criticized Israel today for the ground operation, the United States supports it?
The United States has always been a fervent supporter of Israel. And I think we always think about how you balance various aspects. But if I were a European country, I'd be particularly sensitive to how I criticize Israel.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, by now, let's just say if you're a European country, you should be particularly sensitive about how you're making Palestinians pay for your crimes against Jews. That's what you should be embarrassed about. If you want to, you know, use the Holocaust as they so clearly are and so shamelessly are, and they're, you know, really just weaponizing the Holocaust to justify more genocide. It's absolutely disgusting. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on the way that Trump is obviously either he doesn't care that people are starving, that's probable. And at the same time, I mean, whether or not he's doesn't care. I mean, I guess I'm hoping some Trump America firsters will tell him he looks like a fool, because he's saying that we're going to fix the hunger, the starvation, and he's letting the Netanyahu continue to kill and starve people. And one more thing I want to show, and then I'm going to get your response, is I hope some people show this video to Trump, because he should be a little disturbed by things that Netanyahu has said about America in the past. Okay, so this is interesting, because this is kind of a parallel in some ways to, you're going to hear a concern from a woman that kind of parallels the thinking of Smotrich. So Netanyahu was saying to bring them to the point, Palestinians, of being afraid that everything is collapsing, okay? And someone there with him says, wait a moment, but then the world will say, how come you're conquering again, right? The world won't say a thing. The world, we're defending. Aren't you afraid of the world, BB? Especially today with America. I know what America... Sorry, let me... This is a little hard to read, so I'm going to read out loud. Especially today with America, I know what America is. America is something that can easily be moved to the right direction. They say they're for us, but it's like... They won't get in our way. They won't get in our way. On the other hand, if we do something, then they... So let's say they say something. So they said it. 80% of Americans support us. It's absurd. We have that kind of support, and we say, what will we do with the... Look, the administration, Clinton, the Clinton administration was extremely pro-Palestinian. I wasn't afraid to maneuver there. I was not afraid to clash with Clinton. I was not afraid to clash with the United Nations. I was paying the price anyway. I preferred to receive the value for the price. All right. So I'm the only Jew on stage, so I won't embarrass any of you by making jokes about how, as a Jew, I could really do without Netanyahu talking about price and values. Anyway, so Trump, if you're watching this or any of your supporters are watching this, this guy is moving you. He's maneuvering you. So yeah, Ken and Aaron, what do you have to say to people who are hoping that Trump is going to be an America firster?
Well, it gets to the deep state angle, and this, I guess, would be my wheelhouse since I wrote a whole book on the deep state. And there are roughly two ways of thinking of the deep state. There's the clandestine part of it, the sort of most obscure, sensitive, secretive, lawless, clandestine apparatus within this system, within this regime, within the state. And then there's the bigger sort of there's the bigger structural aspect of it. What I mean is the sense let me think of a way to say this. That's not going to be too academic. It's like the regime itself. The state is all those institutions that have a monopoly on violence in a given territory. But in political science terms, the regime is all of those institutions that determine who has access to the state. So the other sense of deep state is more of in the regime sense of the word. It's kind of a bigger concept that is really all of those institutions that allow for top-down oligarchic rule in a nominal democracy. And in that sense, when you're talking about the deep state, you're not talking about is the deep state going to win or is the deep state going to lose? Are you going to take them on and defeat them or not? It's really about accommodation. And you have all of these entrenched oligarchic forces. And presidents take office, and they cannot go around confronting all the most powerful institutionalized factions of the oligarchy and the regime. If they do, they will just be destroyed. You've got to try to accommodate them. So under JFK, he, of course, accepts the basic cosmology of the Cold War and always says, of course, capitalism is the best possible system, you know. There's no way you could really talk very seriously about going against the orthodoxies of the U.S. You have to accommodate them and move on the margins. That's more or less the way things work. So in Trump's case, he has confronted parts of the deep state, like those elements in the FBI and CIA that tried to keep him from getting elected. And he has moved the U.S. away from the quest for unipolar, full spectrum neoconservative dominance. He has, in his speech, he denounced neoconservatism, and he seems to be moving away from that in his other statements and returning to a more kind of crude Monroe Doctrine, Western Hemisphere style of imperialism. So he's not an anti-imperialist, but he is attempting to confront what we could have called the deep state for the last few decades, which is a neoconservative entity bent on a consensus bent on unipolar global dominance and forever stopping Russia and China and making sure, of course, Israel uber alles. But he's not confronting elements of the deep state represented by Miriam Adelson, for example. I mean, he has confronted the deep state in some ways, but in other ways, he is simply he's always been a part of the deep state. He's never advocated for open governance and real democracy that would eliminate the basis for oligarchic, anti-democratic, lawless rule. So he's not taking on the deep state. He is confronting aspects or segments of the deep state And this maybe have been behind the assassination attempts against him, because even saying you're going to back away from the unipolar project is going to upset some powerful actors. But when you've got Marco Rubio, who I'm no fan of, but when you have somebody like him even coming out and saying, hey, the unipolar era is over, that marks a change in the grand strategy, if we can call it that, of the U.S. regime. The problem is that Trump doesn't really have any coherent strategy. And with Israel, it's most obvious that his rhetoric about ending, you know, forever wars and so on, this is incompatible with trying to please people like Miriam Adelson and other Zionists, who by now, I think we have to say, have a kind of Nazified ideology, just in the act by the definition of the term. I mean, Lebensraum, Untermenschen, master race, there are precise analogs within Zionist ideology. I'm not saying that they're capital N Nazis, because that doesn't make any sense. They don't like Hitler, but they're lowercase.
Well, there were collaboration.
They're lowercase Nazi, as a meaning genocidal, blood and soil fascist. That fits pretty well.
Right. And there was collaboration between Nazis and Zionists, as you know, Tony Greenstein writes about. And certainly Israel depends on and appreciates, I think, anti-Semitism.
I always wonder online when you see these unhinged anti-Semites, that I always wonder what percentage of them are just Israel sock puppets. But, you know, that's just
maybe,
a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, they arrested some guy a couple of years ago who had called in threats to over 1,000 synagogues. He was an Israeli.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So wow. You search it on YouTube, you'll find it. If I could comment on this, to take this really full circle, I think those people in Israel right now are the natural descendants of the fascist Zionists who admired Mussolini for bombing the Ethiopian villages. And we had a lot of people in this country that thought fascism was great. I mean, Mussolini ended up on the cover of Time magazine. Anybody that ever visits New York, go up Fifth Avenue, get to Rockefeller Center, look on the facing Fifth Avenue. There's a pavilion that the Rockefellers built, and it is a beautiful embossed statuary with the words Italia on it. It's gorgeous. That was built for the Mussolini government by the Rockefellers. So we are the Nazis. The Israelis are the Nazis. The Nazis were the Nazis. And we're just doing what Nazis do.
Right. The only ones who aren't Nazis, well, not the only ones, but the people who aren't Nazis are the Palestinians, who ironically get called that. Oh, look at this. Israeli police arrest suspect in bomb threats made against American Jewish centers. Wow.
He was busy.
U.S. officials told NBC News that a motive remains unclear on the suspect.
No, something mysterious.
Yeah, I know. Who knows?
And then,
who knew?
Then his defense was insanity. That was legal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Meshuggah. Meshuggah. That was technically the term. Yeah. Thank you guys so much for joining. Actually, before I let you go, I want to show you and everyone watching that I'll be participating. Speaking of Judaism not being Zionism and Zionism being quite fascistic, and a lot of people have said, you know, at least the Nazis were covering up what they were doing. I will be taking part in a pretty cool Congress. Let me just share my screen here. It is the Jewish Anti-Zionist Congress in Vienna.
Wow.
So joining forces with Palestinians and allies in the struggle against Zionism. The world watches in horror the unfolding genocide against the Palestinian people committed by Zionism in partnership with the West. As Jews, it is our duty to take action, as this is done in our name. So we must join our Palestinian brothers and sisters in their darkest hour and work for freeing and decolonizing Palestine. To achieve this aim, we must have progressive organizations and individuals across the world with us, working against Zionist apartheid, ethnic cleansing, and genocide as the last devastating evidence of colonialism, which must be terminated. And so here, as you can see, here are some of the people taking part. Stephen Kaposch, who's a character in the documentary that we're working on, which is about Holocaust survivors who are speaking out against the genocide. So Stephen is speaking. Rima Hassan, who's a French-Palestinian jurist and member of the European Parliament. Gadi Karma, who's a Palestinian physician, academic, and writer, and she's also a survivor of the Nakba. And her book, she wrote a book called One State, the Only Democratic Future for Palestine, Israel. which is a book that Stephen Kaposch really likes. Ilan Pape will be there, the great Israeli historian. Lami Stik, who is great. She's an attorney and human rights advocate, specializing in defending Arab and Muslim community members. Iris Heifetz, people may remember I interviewed Iris. She's great. She's an Israeli Jewish woman who moved to Germany, and she was like arrested for a sign that said, "This Israeli Jew opposes genocide." There's me. Chaim Breshid Zabner, he's another character we're following around, and he is someone that has been on our show. Chaim is the son of survivors, and he was arrested for saying that Israel won't be able to defeat Hamas. He was arrested for that. He wrote a great book called An Army Like No Other, How the IDF Made Israel. Did I mention Tony Greenstein? He's also been on the show, the author of the great book, Zionism During the Holocaust, The Weaponization of Memory and the Service of State and Nation. Ronnie Barkin, an Israeli dissident, co-founder of Boycott From Within, Anarchists Against the Wall, and Palestine Action Member. And he's been arrested, and he also was kicked out of, so he was harassed by the German secret police following his Munich talk at Professor Huber Platz, where he connected the legacy of the White Rose, who opposed Nazism, with direct action in opposition to Zionism. I'm sure there will be streaming of it. Actually, I'm not sure there will be streaming of it. I don't know. But what I am sure of is that you should attend if you can. If you're in Vienna or anywhere near Vienna, come check it out. It's going to be a historic Congress, and I'm really excited about it.
Great.
And we'll put the link in the description. Yeah,
that is historic. It's so important, and it's a good location to have it.
Your coverage over the last... last couple of years here, really, now we're going on, however long it's been, Jesus. You've been great overall. So I'm impressed that you're doing that. It's an ordeal to travel across the ocean and do something like that. So I tip my hat to you for that.
Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
Easter should be the best day of the year. It's a celebration of the resurrection of hope. Come to Crossroads Church and celebrate an empty tomb and a living hope. Info and service times at crossroads.net.